Well, hello. Good afternoon. Sláinte, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, joining you from my bunker in the soon-to-be red-zoned wonderful city of Guelph. Shouldn't laugh about that, but it sounds like it's brewing up, and I don't think we're going to talk about it today, but of course we will eventually. And joining me from his own sector of the red zone, on the line via Skype phone, hopefully, is Adam A. Donaldson. Adam, are you there?
I'm here. I'm not sure if it's a red zone yet. We should maybe...
Reddish?
Wait for the official word on that.
Unofficially? Rumor has it. No, you are correct in that. But until then, we have a lot to discuss. At 5:30, we have an interview that Adam did a bit earlier with Peter Smith from the Canadian Anti-Hate Network to talk about the rise of hate. Something that has always been with us, but in these days, things have gotten a lot worse. Something else has gotten a lot worse that we are also going to discuss is the homelessness situation, specifically Montreal this weekend, where things came to a bit of a head, and this week, but also in the rest of the nation. But Adam, speaking of coming to a head, we had quite an interesting weekend regarding the Conservation Authority and Greenbelt Council situation, in that 7 people resigned from that council due to the government's plans, which is limiting the mandate of conservation areas in this province. I believe David Crombie, who ex-mayor, popular mayor of Toronto, who was on that committee, described the situation as a high-level bombing of the Conservation Authority system in the province, pretty much thrown out the window by the sounds of it with the legislation that was passed earlier this week. Or was it late last week? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was Wednesday. Tuesday or Wednesday.
Yes.
Whatever the last day the legislature sat for the year was, now that I'm talking about it out loud, I think it was Tuesday. I remember getting that notice.
Yes, and have I got to write they're off till February now? Did I hear that somewhere? That's it for...
I think, yeah, no, that is correct. That is not unusual, though. The last couple of years, they've been taking the pretty much all of January off and most of February off until Family Day, and then they come back the day after Family Day.
No prorogue required, just long vacay.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's another story, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, I don't know if you had a question there, but the Green... I was going to say the Greenbelt situation, but it is the Conservation Authority situation. Although I think, considering that half the Greenbelt committee resigned, I think they are seeing this as sort of the next phase, or at least thinking ahead about the next phase of this. Because, you know, since the Ford government came into power, one of their big, let's say, areas is has been the Greenbelt, and trying to find a ways to open up the Greenbelt to expansion, to development, ostensibly to, you know, in the words of the Ford government, to create more like land developing opportunities to get more housing built, cheaper housing built, more affordable housing built. That is definitely not the case, though, because we're talking about rather pristine areas that will go for top dollar if they are ever put on the market. They have consistently failed at this, though. There has been consistently been outrage, well-organized outrage about any attempts to go after the Green Belt. There has been outrage, but significantly less loud outrage when it comes to doing things like reducing the funding of conservation authorities, which is something they did last budget, and that seems to be the soft underbelly that the Ford government seems to realize that they can go for now. They can attack the conservation areas, they can get away with that, and perhaps it's something of a war of attrition now, that it's going to be slowly poking holes at the areas around the Green Belt until they can get to the point where they will in fact be able to get some sort of development action on the Green Belt, which I think maybe the long game that David Crombie and others on that committee were probably looking towards.
Mm-hmm. And earlier in the week, they threw a bit of cover. What was it, $30 million for wetland restoration? Just to kind of, I guess, make it look like something is happening. Distraction money, in my opinion, anyway. To But it obviously didn't cover this completely because the story is still snowballing. I think today the NDP was alleging that the main benefactors of something like this, including the ministerial zoning order, which is something that can come from municipal affairs and housing, where they can just sort of override everything and say, no, the development is going to go there, regardless of how many frogs or what type of wetland it is, and if it's pristine, as you said, they have this magic ability to just demand this is going on top of that. And it sounds like 19 out of the 38 people that have gotten these MZOs in the past little while, which were rare for the longest time, they weren't very common. 50% of them are actually, they drew the lines and drew the ties to the Progressive Conservative government of Ontario in terms of people that are within the sphere, but also, contributors to the party. Obviously, we know now that companies, unions can't give to parties now, but through various means, they've determined that this is who are getting these favors allegedly. So that's part of it. And if of course, if we think back to there was that before the election, or as the election campaign was going on, there was that the secret meeting about opening up the Greenbelt. Mm-hmm. So it's not so secret now. The fact that this happened shouldn't surprise anybody. We're getting back to, COVID obviously still roiling away, but we're kind of getting back to, the previous year or 2 years prior to our 2020 COVID year, where this is the kind of thing that was almost expected to come from the Ford government, in that they kind of promised that this was going to happen, and now it is happening. And as to whether they're doing it under COVID to kind of slide it through, thinking no one will notice, should be no surprise that lots of people have noticed that this has happened.
Right, but it took a while. The budget came out on November the 5th, I want to say. It was like the last Friday. It was the first Friday of the month. And it wasn't until like the end of the month when you start getting, at least locally, you started hearing the Grand River Conservation Authority going, holy crap, holy crap, holy crap. This is what's also in this omnibus bill, this budget bill. And then they called an emergency meeting. And then that night, Guelph City Council endorsed their call to basically ask the provincial government to shelve this until there was more consultation done. And obviously that didn't come to pass. And it was a rather quick turnaround. But you're right, this is sort of like a similar maneuver to the 2019 budget, when that dropped and people started digging, people took a cursory look at it and go, oh, well, it's not, it's not bad. It's not the cut fest we thought that Doug Ford was going to deliver in his first budget. And then people started digging through it and going, holy crap, holy crap, holy crap. Look at all this, all this fine print that undermines, funding for conservation authorities and folding together ambulance services and all this other thing. And, this is of a piece of that. Somebody in the Premier's office or the Minister of Finance's office or the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing's offices, or perhaps all three, were really on the ball with this, that they were able to bury this, that this was, they knew that a lot of the focus was going to be on the deficit, was going to be on spending, and that's where it was. And a lot of people's eyes glossed over the fact that there was this new attack on conservation authorities underneath. And if this really was about reorienting conservation authorities or to make things more streamlined or cutting red tape or any of that, BS, it would have been done straight out instead of being buried in an omnibus bill. So, it's just whether or not you think the conservation authorities could use a rejigger. There could be some reasonable arguments to that regard, that I know that there are a lot of people in rural areas that feel like when it comes to their own personal property, like small landowners, like homeowners, that maybe GRCA has too much say over what they can, or not just GRCA, but conservation authorities in general, maybe have too much say over what they can do on their property. That's perfectly valid. You're allowed to feel that way, and you're allowed to work that out with your conservation authorities however you see fit. But this is not meant to, as you were indicating, this is not meant to benefit small homeowners. This is meant to benefit big corporations that are looking to start some things. And of course, one of the things that one of the places a lot of people are looking at is Pickering, where they want to add this big addition to the Durham Entertainment Complex, a movie studio and warehouses, and it's going to be right there on wetlands. And of course, the mayor of Pickering and Pickering Council have applied for an MZO, and so, you know, they're good to go. And the last line of defense was the conservation area, who were like saying, well, hold on, maybe we don't want to build great big things on our wetlands, and now that's not a problem.
I mean, it's not as if that the conservation authorities couldn't use a bit of retooling. It's a well-established system. I think it evolved after the war and came to a head during Hurricane Hazel, if I understand it right, in which the entire Humber Valley got washed. There was houses there. So, you know, these exist for a reason. I think there may as well be a bit of buck passing going on, because they are sort of subject to local areas, and they'll say, well, you know, Durham region or such and such a region requested this, so we want to make it happen. But is that necessarily for the best, right? If you have, but by the sounds of some of this policy, pay to slay has arisen once again, which is one of those turn of phrases that, you know, says exactly what it is, where a developer will be able to go in and take out a certain amount of wetland, or, you know, you name it, something that should be protected, as long as there's an equal amount somewhere else. And that, you know, that it's definite false equivalency stuff, because once it's gone, mm-hmm. I always point back to the Bullfrog Mall, right? Let's take out the bullfrogs, but we'll name the mall after them and everything's okay. But it isn't really, because there's no bullfrogs anymore. So to have this sort of broad strokes, and of course, COVID once again being used as a universal excuse for anything, they'll be like, well, the economy's in the dumps, so we need to do this. We absolutely have to do this, because if we don't, everything is going to collapse. It's like, no, the bottom line of the Friends, in my opinion, is what's going to collapse. I mean, Ford referred to it, I can't remember if it was at the plowing match where he was on the Ford tractor, and this came up. They're talking of, yeah, of course, what else would he ride, right? And he equated, you know, conservation areas to just, I think his exact words were like, well, it's just farmers' fields. And that, you know, this mm-hmm. is somebody that does, like, that's ignorance in my view. And as I said, this is getting back to the government that scrapped cap and trade, trashing green energy contracts, the stupid sticker program. I still think the guy's a climate change denier, right? I still feel that deeply, that it's like, you know, this should be no surprise, right? Really?
Yeah. Well, you're right. There is buck passing too, and I mean, it's going to bite somebody at some point in the butt, whether it involves conservation authorities or not. And if you look at, this is getting a little bit off topic, but it is on topic of the MZOs in Stratford, where you have the mayor there applying for an MZO to make way for this Zinyi plant that Guelph Aramosa rejected. And, you know, now that he's hearing more about it, he's maybe a little concerned that he jumped the gun going for that MZO before all the facts are in. It's like, yeah. So now what? Is Zinyi going to turn around and take you to LPAT and talk about, well, you know, you were all full speed ahead on creating all these great jobs where, you know, there definitely aren't going to be dormitories to make people live at work? Wink. So it's
pretty big. I mean, whoopsie if that just goes through, right? It was like, oh,
right. It's bound for, I mean, whether it's Zinyi in Stratford, whether it's this, you know, area in Pickering or whatever, there's going to be a situation where just the rush is going to blow up in somebody's face at some point, and it's all in the name of jobs. And it's not just about, like, we're back to a point where it's not just a matter of, like, what is the employment? Does it pay somebody a living wage? Does it let somebody live here? Does it let somebody afford a home here? It's just a matter of, it's jobs, J-O-B, jobs, and...
Yeah, it's almost an obsession.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if, you know, considering these regs, if the glass plant proposal was happening down the road, it probably would have happened, right? So much has changed in that period that, you know, we probably would have ended up with a glass plant in Guelph Aramosa. But so the Stratford battle continues. We should probably look a bit more into that at a future date. But
well, the meeting's on Monday at Stratford Council.
Oh, is he? Okay, there you go. So maybe topic time for next week. Mm-hmm. But back to current topics. Also on the weekend, there was a fire. A very large homeless encampment in Montreal, and this prompted the city of Montreal to take action and essentially clear out the camp. It sounded like it wasn't a violent clearing of the camp like you do see where they come in just with dozers and level everything. But there seemed to be, I don't know if you saw any of it, Adam, but there was a heck of a lot of police that blocking the road. I watched a bit on the Journal de Montréal where they had blocked the road and there was waves of police. And there was also police in riot gear and firefighters. So it was like all these first responders were coming and clearing this housing encampment out. It sounds like most of the people that were in it have just moved on to other parts of Montreal. So there's this diaspora from this long, it was on Notre Dame, right? There's this very long green bar. I don't know how well you know Montreal, but it's actually the perfect spot to set up tents. But this speaks to the situation under, not just under COVID, but COVID has brought a lot to a head in terms of people that are just kind of on the edge of homelessness, problems in the shelters in terms of, well, there are the normal group of problems within any shelter, but COVID sort of adds this other layer to everything. And it's like, you know, do you really want to go into the shelter system if there's a strong possibility you might end up with COVID or something else? So you can see why a lot of people are camping out green space, but it seems to be so many now, like so many more compared to, previous years, recent years anyway.
Right. And we don't know the full extent of what the COVID impact is going to be. And in fact, there was a report, a federal government report released today. And so this was well timed on our part that we will not know the full extent of the impact of COVID on homelessness for 3 to 5 years. But it could be a 10 to 15% increase in that time as well. And a lot of this has to do with, you know, not just what happens in the immediate term and vaccines and things, but you know, whether or not the labor market bounces back, you know, we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be. That, you know, we've been through a year where everything's been upset now, and you see this happening in small conversations where all over the place, whether it's like you know, the economic tables at the Chamber of Commerce or in city council meetings or whatever, where it's like, you know, people aren't going to be doing a lot of business travel anymore because we've gotten so used to Zoom. People aren't going to be maybe eating out as much because food prices are expected to go up. And the food prices thing too is not necessarily because of COVID directly, but it is because of things like the fluctuating dollar with exports. And I mean, yeah, also because COVID has sacked meat plants pretty good. But yeah, there's just so many unanswered questions that even the people who, you know, are paid to look at the trends of homelessness are just saying, like, we don't know what this is going to look like even like 36 months from now. But I mean, having said that, they are saying, you know, a 10 to 15% jump in homelessness, that's not small potatoes.
No, absolutely not. And this, you know, we've seen promises for years for social housing for people. I think Montreal had made a big promise saying we were going to build 15,000 units. I think they've clocked in at about 2,000, but they're wanting the people in this park in particular, but anyone in Montreal, to go into the shelter system, which is something they want. The ones that are there obviously want to avoid. But In seeing this, because it actually made international media, I saw another story in Glasgow where they had taken a hotel and it's near the main central station and converted it to housing for homeless people from the beginning of COVID, like March, the same as us. And there was a report that 9 people have died in that hotel since March. But it's similar to here in lots of ways, but the weird part was, like, they said, well, we don't really know, we don't know the reasons to why this is happening. And it's like, well, we sort of do know the reasons as to why it lends itself to, like, an Agatha Christie novel. It's like the hotel where nine people died. Like, this, it isn't just, you know, you can find spaces for people and put them up. There needs to be, you know, structural services as well. But turning to Toronto for a minute, because I was reading and hearing a bit about this today, because it was sent to me. There's an eviction blitz going on in Toronto right now. I don't know if you heard anything about this, but the hearings, the eviction hearings, have all gone online. And it sounds like some people are getting evicted, like, within a minute. They try and log in, and of course, as we know, people that are in precarious situations may have trouble with Zoom and those kinds of things, may not even have the money to appear. And 60 seconds is like, boom, you're evicted, you're evicted, you're evicted. Where do all of those people go? If we don't have a hotel system or anything set up for them to go, and they can't couch surf because of restrictions due to COVID, where are they going to go? So this, you know, you were saying about, we won't know the full extent of it. Whatever it is, in you know, when we're able to look back in a few years, it's going to be massive. It's going to be massive.
There's a lot of short-sightedness too, and you know, I admit I didn't know this until I started looking into homelessness. Not because I was homeless a couple of years ago, but you know, just in terms of my interest on the issue. You can sure say enough, like, well, why are you living in a tent by the river? Why don't you just go to a shelter? We're told there are lots of shelter space. Well, number one, there's a pastor in Toronto who he did a little social media video where he was on the line with a shelter on the phone, finding out there are no spaces at the shelter. Meanwhile, on the city of Toronto's website, it says, no, go to the shelter. There's lots of space. So there. I mean, that's anecdotal, of course. So there may be more to that story. But I mean, anecdotal stories like that do have a habit of getting around and make people doubt the system. And I don't know how the shelters in Montreal or Toronto work, but I know that here in Guelph, you get 28 days. You go to the shelter, you get 28 days. Whether you find a home or not, you're out on day 29. And by the way, you know, a shelter doesn't give you a place to be at during the day. You know, from dawn till dusk, you are more or less on your own to find someplace warm to be. And I mean, also to carry all your own stuff around, which, you know, why you see people with carts and you know, bike trailers filled with things. And when you're doing that, and when you're, you know, carting your life around, waiting for the end of the day when you can go back to the shelter. I mean, sometimes pitching a tent down by the river just makes so much more sense, because at least you're in one place. And yeah, the police may chase you at some point, but at least you have your own space, and you also have safety in numbers, which is one of the things about, you know, the camp lifestyle, is that you know, people form communities, they look out for each other, and it just, you know, it speaks to, I don't know if ignorance is the right word, but just, you know, yeah, you can go to the shelter, but there are limitations to being in a shelter too, and none of that gets people anywhere close to ending their homelessness either.
Yeah, and that's part of, again, another part of the problem right now is the lack of things and services that are open. Since we're all red, you know, we're not all red zone, but in key places, you can't go and sit in a place anymore all day. McDonald's is a good example. Tim Hortons, those places are always populated. Or the mall, always populated by people. We're saying, going back to Montreal for a second, that in for women in particular, to stay safe, they've taken to riding the metro all day with all of their belongings, like you say. There's reports of that happening because it's safer than just sort of being, you know, wherever you are, or trying to seek shelter and seek safety. It's very, very difficult to do these days because there's this so little open. I mean, the metro's open, but there's, you know, there's no, with lack of space and everything, it's just you're riding around all day until you can find a place at night. Mm-hmm. So there's so many things, but going back to that international story, I was led to that because there was a, and you probably heard this as well, that there was a case of something called trench fever among some homeless people. I believe it was in Winnipeg. Yeah. Now, this is something that, it's not very common at all, but there has been an outbreak of it in Winnipeg. It was something that was quite common for soldiers in the trenches of World War One, and that's why this is such a big story. You get it from infected lice feces. That is where trench fever comes from. So we're at the point now where there are people living in this nation that we are all supposedly supposed to be so proud of that are getting diseases that are just obscure. Never mind COVID, which is bad enough, but something like that surprises people that in this nation and in the cities of Canada, that something like that can surface again, and that all of these conditions snowball into something, to a situation like this that doesn't seem to have any, you know, hard resolution on the horizon other than building places for people.
Right. And none of it addresses either a lot of the core systemic things. And I did make a note of that at the Guelph, not to bring things back local, Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis had their December 6th memorial online this year. And among the comments there was that, it's not just about stopping the violence, which, of course, is something we all want to do. But it's also stopping the causes of violence, like lack of affordable housing, lack of a living wage. All these things are connected, and it's straight up a couple of things. It's straight up impossible to address homelessness until you address the fact that it's really hard for people to afford a place to live in certain places in this country, and that has a lot to do with how little they're paid in certain jobs, and then. Also, it has to do with like just prevailing attitudes about homelessness. And again, we're seeing that locally too with the proposed Kindle project in the Willow Road area, where there were people, writing letters to the Trib and the Today about quote unquote those people moving into the area. So
yeah, between the letters and comments sections of any stories on this, it's like the abyss. But yeah, there, if I understand it right, there are zero neighborhoods in Guelph that are affordable for somebody who is a full-time minimum wage worker. So it's not just, people always point to the subset of like, well, they're stealing bikes and blah, blah, blah. It's not just that, right? It is well beyond just the atypical, stereotypical, judgmental things that people do and say, well, you should do this. You shouldn't, like, it's an oversimplification for sure. And definitely something that we are going to keep on both burners, probably, because it is the it is the never-ending story, both in this town and in the country and in the world. But we're going to take a little bit of a breather here, play a couple of ads of sorts, promotional stuff, and a little bit of music, and then we will be back after this short break to continue the show. So please stay tuned. Fantastic, the late Sharon Jones with the Dap Kings, and that song can only mean one thing. Hag Hanukkah Samach to our Jewish friends out there, because today is indeed the first day of Hanukkah, and when they start talking about brisket and latkes, I'm just like, oh my goodness gracious me, it's like the best. So happy Hanukkah to you. And I think I play that every year because we always land on, this show always lands on Hanukkah. So we need more hip hop happening in Hanukkah songs. So, Adam, you have an interview for us.
Yes, Peter Smith from the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. And we've covered a lot of that ground this year. So I guess this kind of wraps up a lot of what we've covered this year and a lot of what's going on in the news lately. So I will just leave that there because it's a long interview and we have a short period of time to play it in.
Excellent. Let's go.
I am now being joined by Peter Smith from the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. Peter, how are you today?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me on today.
No problem. Maybe a general question to start off with. 2020 as a year for hate groups. I mean, I think this is like the second full year for the network to be operating. I mean, are you having an impact? Is, you know, maybe this year just too overwhelming to look at it objectively because of everything that's going on? I mean, what's the status of hate in Canada in 2020?
We've definitely seen a rise in popularity of a lot of the ideas that we would associate with hate groups. You know, I'm hesitant to say that the pandemic has caused a large increase, or we've tracked that it's caused a large increase. But there's no doubt that it has become a rallying point for a lot of hate groups, or just with the ongoing kind of conspiracy-based protests that we're seeing across the country. They're embracing a lot of figures and who are associated with hate. And then those figures are also, you know, they're bringing their concepts with them. So we see a lot of Q type stuff without necessarily mentioning QAnon itself at these places. And then, yeah, they're always looking for ways to join the like cause celeb of the day. And right now the big one is the lockdown, and people are nervous and people are concerned. So, I mean, that is a perfect environment for these types of groups to thrive and recruit. But the actual effect of what 2020 will be, I don't think we'll fully understand until the year is over.
To address what you said, though, about, you know, I guess the lockdown and a lot of COVID concern as kind of like a gateway drug to other broader conspiracies and hate situations. Like a lot of people, I was watching, my mom was watching the protests at Adamson Barbecue a couple of weeks ago. And she made the point, like, nobody there seems to be protesting the same thing. Everyone seems to have a different cause. And you know, your group addresses in a post on your website about this. Are these groups like just sort of following where the camera lights are, or is there like an underlying organization that if you're looking at, no matter how disparate, you know, the different issues people are protesting are, they are kind of all in the same boat because they're basically all on the fringe together?
Yeah, Adamson's was really unique. I was actually there during the day that it all really went down, when Skelly was arrested, the owner. And it's true, like, they, especially the guys who have kind of made this their whole business, like, they've made being a you know, like a spreader of these ideas, you know, a big part of their identity. Like Kevin J. Johnson, Pat King, like, you were seeing them, these yellow vests, typically like anti-Muslim type of guys who are glomming on, they are following the camera lights. But you were also looking at a time where people are really frustrated with what's going on, and the government and the policies that are put in place. And, you know, we always want to be careful not to put down people's dissatisfaction with legitimate things, legitimate concerns. But yeah, when you show up at these protests, it is about, you know, celebrity pedophile cabals. You know, it's about overarching like New World Order type globalist conspiracy theories. And then, of course, just out and out racism. So it is a wide spectrum of different groups and different beliefs, but they've come together because they can like roughly agree that there is a, you know, some kind of hoax being perpetrated on all of us. And yeah, that common thread is what ties them all together, even if the little specifics of it are going to be different.
Right. It all goes back to the same bad guy, which is basically the government in some way.
Right. You know, there's a lot of popular figures, Bill Gates, George Soros, you know, the typical kind of cast of characters that you hear.
The usual suspects.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to go back to something you said also about people who people who say they are not with QAnon, but are basically spouting QAnon talking points. I encountered this on my own. There was a bit of a gathering here in Guelph back in August. It was basically like a "we're living our lives" celebration in the park. And when I approached them to talk about it, one of the first things out of their mouth was, "Well, we're not with QAnon. We don't believe in the QAnon stuff." But I mean, they had all the QAnon, you know, buzzwords down, and all the talking points down. And I'm curious, in your experience, you know, are we like in a situation where, you know, maybe QAnon it's become like the bad brand name, but people still believe like the basic tenets? And I mean, what happens then? Because I think people hear QAnon and a rational part of their brain goes, okay, we're going to just put that in a silo because that is crazy stuff. But it's the brand name that's toxic, the ideas that are catching on now.
Well, I mean, Q is also publicly known. Like, you can go to like my dad and say QAnon, and he'll know what it is, like, not as a believer, but, you know, it's been reported extensively on. So yeah, it has been branded negatively. And then, especially in a Canadian context, where you see is it's based around the cult of personality of Donald Trump, which, you know, a lot of non-Q, anti-mask, anti-lockdown people are showing a lot of Trump love. But yeah, its origins, I think, in being so America-focused, and then all of the bad press, like you mentioned, has made it something that Canadians are a little distasteful of or a little hesitant. But what Q does so well is kind of serve as like a mosaic of all these older conspiracy theories pieced together, along with the constantly evolving new narratives that one, Q is putting out, but two, his like very engaged online followers are kind of creating. Because I mean, some Q drops, which like the way that he communicates or the way that they communicate with the world is through these drops, like these message board posts that are just from a very specific address. And yes, yeah, so some of them are huge paragraphs and other ones are just like a YouTube link. You know, we heard from Q for the first time in I think almost like over 20 days yesterday. And it was just like an amp up video to Twisted Sister with a bunch of America stuff. Like, I think the unique Americanness makes Q just a bridge a bit too far. But whereas he pulls in stuff like Pizzagate that preceded him, or you know, the very old New World Order globalist conspiracy theories, which is usually just like a very thin code for Jewish people. Yeah, I think it's hard with Q because it draws from so much and then pushes out so much. It's this like this interactive wheel that keeps on turning. So like QAnon will probably end at some point. Like, I don't think it's going to be anytime soon, but there will be a part where, you know, Q drops off, but this line of conspiracy, I think, that they have built or the mythology is built, is going to continue on.
And maybe we're seeing kind of the first wave of that, because like you said, we're, you know, Trump is not a Canadian figure and has a very, I mean, even in conservative circles, I think, you know, there was a poll that said 40% of conservatives would consider voting for Trump. And that those are the, you know, the people who would probably vote for Trump if he were running in a Canadian election. But he seems to have a very soft touch here in Canada, you know, even so far as the influence of American politics here.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's because he's such a polarizing figure, and initially was distasteful for a lot of conservative or moderate conservatives. I mean, I have a weird perspective because I spend so much time in kind of extremist or more fringe spaces where, you know, you see the flags and he is very popular. I certainly think that he has some mainstream conservative appeal in Canada, but yeah, nothing. We haven't seen anything like his support in the States.
I want to move on to something that's, you know, going on in Toronto right now, the trial of Alec Manassian. I know that you are not covering that for the network, but just maybe generally, and maybe this puts you in a unique position, but I mean, I don't really see it being covered on the nightly news. Like when I turn it on the TV news, I don't really see it being covered. And I would have thought it would be a bigger thing. And maybe that's because of the pandemic and other things going on. But should we be paying more attention to this? Like, is this like something that, at least, even just legally speaking, is going to have like long-term ramifications for us and how we deal with, you know, hate issues here in Canada?
Oh, I think the trial itself and its results is going to be incredibly important. As for it not receiving like daily coverage, I have watched some of the days and I read up on it before coming into this interview, but you're looking at something like a 26 day scheduled trial. Mm. The defense expert, who is arguing that, Manassian's autism disorder, is what caused like a, I don't want to say a quote, but it was something like near psychopathy or like level of detachment, which as soon as that was said, immediately, autism advocacy groups came out and were like, no. So I think the real effect of this trial is going to be if this defense goes forward. The doctor, I believe his name is Dr. Westphal, has published papers about using autism spectrum disorder as a legal defense in these type of cases. So I don't know his past history. I don't know if he's gotten this defense to be successful before, but it does certainly seem like he's trying it out up here. So I would be extremely nervous about legal precedent that will be set. When it comes to persecuting hate groups, the incel community is a very dark place with a lot of people who also, you know, generally need help, but unfortunately have found a very, very toxic community, which, you know, from what we've seen just anecdotally, just feeds into, you know, these feelings of resentment and anger. What effect the trial will have on that group specifically, I couldn't say.
Mm. And indeed, the Crown expert, I noted, I think it was yesterday or the day before, noted that, you know, this is kind of like another kind of school shooting scenario where you have criminals basically trying to one-up each other, and how Manassian used, you know, the memory of Elliot Rodgers basically to kind of psych himself up and, you know, trying to outdo each other and looking at it as... And there is evidence to back this up, too, that school shooters very much were looking at each other's, the past history of it, trying to outdo each other. And the not naming the shooters in the media had a definite effect on that because of, I guess, mitigating some of that celebrity status, to coin a phrase.
Absolutely. I think it's a positive. Like after Christchurch, we heard very little mention in mainstream media of the shooter's name. I'm not going to say it now. And then, you know, this is the glory that they seek in their private spaces, in the encrypted spaces. The most extreme people refer to the shooters like Rodgers, like the Christchurch shooter, as saints. Mm. You know, you are Saint Rodgers. So you are attempting to achieve this level of veneration in your very small community. But it's 100% true. Like they are very aware of what the record is, you know, what the all-time highs are. And, you know, maybe it's a part of that weird gamer culture, but they are trying to, one, court media, two, be remembered, and three, yeah, break the ceiling of whatever anybody said before.
Mm-hmm. Well, since CFRU is based on the University of Guelph campus, I did take a special note of this recent post on the Canadian Anti-Hate Network website about these cases in the McMaster and the University of Ottawa, where you have members of far-right hate groups infiltrating the campus conservative clubs. I don't know how much you were involved in sort of that information gathering or that reporting, but I guess the question is, how concerned should we be? I mean, I know campus conservative members, and you know, they are. I don't understand young people raging for the machine, but leaving that aside, you know, they seem rather earnest. I mean, how vulnerable are campus conservative groups, do you think, into like being infiltrated by people with really negative influences?
Yeah, I mean that's a very important point, that like campus conservative clubs, as much as I'm not a conservative, are not the enemy. What they are for people who are far right extremists or, you know, looking to progress into that, is a legitimate political avenue where they can start to float their ideas. So red pilling someone, as they would call it, is, you know, can start with very kind of mainstream seeming points about immigration, about, you know, a host of other issues, abortion, you know, safe drug supplies, you know, anything that, you know, most conservatives would have questions about, but then eventually leading that into, you know, the idea of superior cultures or superior races, you know, ethno-pluralism or ethno-nationalism is a concept that we see kind of ferment on the, what we call the alt-light, like groups that are just really pro-West, but will accept, you know, racialized members, people of color, you know, as long as they are, one, typically willing to deal with some small measure of racism, and to, yes, just support the idea of a unified West. And then that can shift you further to the right from there. I certainly don't think anybody should be afraid of their local conservative club. It's a group of people with political ideas that might differ from yours, but yeah, they are the target. Like, they are an attractive, legitimate way, especially if you can get into the officer board or onto these committees, which when you're in university is fairly easy to do. Mm-hmm. It gives you some legitimacy, some like political credence. And especially with the like kind of alt-right groups, you know, they're very interested in getting political power eventually.
Mm-hmm. And they come in and are, and I've seen this before with, you know, candidates running for the People's Party. I'm just asking questions, phrasing it like that. It's like, it's innocent. I'm just asking questions and seeing how you've, you know, what you're thinking. And it starts so innocuously like that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there are guides that you can find about how to disguise your rhetoric in memes and in humor. And again, it's something you want to be careful of, because you don't want to become a censor. You don't want to be getting in people's way to express themselves. But when it starts to boil down to like racial superiority, you know, or even just like no mixing, like these very, very old concepts, like it's the same type of rhetoric that was being presented in the 30s, 40s, 50s. It really hasn't changed that much. It's all just being dressed up in another way.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think? I mean, we're almost at the end of the year, so we're almost in 2021. Vaccines are being handed out now, so maybe lockdown issues sort of disappear. What are you concerned about in the new year, and maybe what kind of work are you and the other journalists at the network, you know, working on right now? Not to give away any of your trade secrets, of course, but I mean, for the public who are looking to you know, be vigilant about where the next trends in sort of hate groups pop up, you know, what should people be on the lookout for?
I think this year, what I've noticed the most has been the refining of innocuous posts, like more that memeing that we were talking about, but more in like the Instagram, Facebook, like social media influencer space. You're starting to find people who are adopting that aesthetic, like, you know, bright pastel colors, soft text, you know, clip art. And it's, you know, it's slipping messages in there. Like Save the Children was the best example. There's a great Canadian researcher, Marc-André Allegro, who studies Q. You know, he came up with the term pastel-anon, which is this idea of the, just the influencer space. And it's put out extremely incorrect ideas about how child trafficking works, the numbers, especially in the States, but all over the world, of how many children are being taken or being abused, and is actually getting in the way of the work of people who are trying to effectively combat this. It's not so much, I mean, we are always concerned about terror groups and people organizing to commit violence and explicitly calling for violence. Like, we have those in Canada, we are monitoring them. But my main concern is the creep of this disinformation into the mainstream. And I think, especially this year, and probably before that, we have seen them start to refine the methods. Just as more people come to these spaces.
And I mean, maybe people aren't even aware of how, you know, maybe it starts with asking questions. Maybe it starts with being legitimately concerned about lockdown measures or closing small businesses and things. But I mean, you kind of live and breathe this stuff. And I imagine you, like a lot of us, sort of see people you are friends with or acquaintances with on Facebook who start getting red pilled, who start getting sucked into the machine. How do you react? And maybe at the same time, because I know a lot of people have this question, and sometimes it just ends up with people giving up on their friends or their family members. But I mean, what's your advice to sort of start bringing people back from the edge if you see this happening to someone in your life?
I mean, especially if someone if it's new to them, like, there's still a lot of chance for engagement and conversation. And, you know, you can, there are a lot of people who are very willing to engage in conversation, who hold these beliefs quite strongly. As when it comes to like bringing back people from the edge, like if you're talking about dangerous ideologies, like nationalist, like fascism or, siege culture, like all of these, like really like serious Nazis, like you need to get law enforcement involved. And if you're a parent, talk to somebody about counseling. And that might be an option even in less extreme cases, counseling, not law enforcement. But I mean, ultimately you can try to engage with people and you can try to explain to them, but at some point you have to think about your own mental health and, a person's belief system is ultimately not your responsibility. And trying to force someone to change can push them even further. I guess I'm dancing around the question, because I don't think that there is a silver bullet other than just compassion and understanding and dialogue. Like, it's not going to work for everybody, but reasonable people, people who are open and willing to engage with a variety of ideas, will often be willing to engage with yours as well. It's just you can't make yourself the savior of somebody else.
And your own mental health, if I may ask, you're well?
Oh, I'm doing well. Yeah, man. There's some times, but you develop a bit of a thick skin for it. But the moment, with some of the things that I see, the moment that it would stop bothering me would be the moment that I'd really start to worry.
Very true. Well, Peter Smith, we are grateful for the work you and everybody at CAN does, and we will definitely be keeping our eye on it in the new year. So thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This has been delightful.
And that was Adam speaking to Peter Smith from the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. I should mention, because you did allude to the website there, Adam, it is antihate.ca, an excellent, excellent resource for a lot of the things that were discussed and more.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So, as you said, long interview, and we are indeed out of time. So, Adam, if people are looking for you, if they're looking for you and want to find out why that came out so totally wrong, and what you do, where can they find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to GuelphPolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and you can find us every Thursday at 5 p.m. here at CFRU 93.3 FM. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we will be back next week, same time, same channel. So please tune in. Take care, folks.